Portions of this hour brought to you by River Valley Health. In sports, you get what you train for. Make the most of your off-season with RVH's athlete programs. Call 430-9224 or visit rivervalleyhealth.com.
The Jason Greger Show, presented by Mobile One. Energy lives here on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260.
Just after 5 o'clock, looks like a few rain clouds on the west end rolling in. Claussen said there might be a few showers, so we'll see. Blind squirrel finds an acorn every now and then for old JC, so he could be right. Very happy to have our next guest in studio. Many of you used to listen to him on the Edmonton Airways for many years. As he was the first guy who really took sports radio across the country after games, and then wrote in the Edmonton Journal, the Edmonton Sun for a long time, now working for the Alberta Sports Connection, John Short joins us. Johnny, how are you?
I'm well, and how are you?
Hey, I'm good.
And you're still the only guy I know who's ever called me Johnny, which I think is so funny.
Quickly, what are you doing at the Alberta Sports Connection?
Well, I'm the chair. We have a 10-member board, a whole bunch of bright people who every so often question what I'm doing as the chair, but we've never answered that. The Alberta Sport Connection used to be known as the Alphabet Foundation, Alberta Sports, Recreation, Parks, and Wildlife Foundation. And we fund about 80 amateur sports organizations, provincial and organizations. We fund the Alberta Summer Games, Alberta Winter Games. We're involved now in dealing with the 55-plus games for people who soon will be welcoming you to compete.
Long time for me. Brownlee's a star in that category.
Well, he'd say that anyway.
Yeah, maybe in the 70 and over club, he'd be in on that. So now that's obviously near and dear to your heart because you are always a huge proponent of amateur sports as much as pro.
Amateur and participation. You know, I mean, that's where it all starts. The big stories are, as we know, the Gretzky's and the Sathers and those who go on to make millions of dollars. But the foundation of all sport is the kid who starts, the kid who moves to the level where we kind of take responsibility just after the high school level. Somebody's got the potential to become. We have a program called Own the Podium, and we spend a lot of money every year for kids who've got an opportunity to ultimately, we hope, compete in the Olympics, the World Championships, maybe the Pan American Games. You know, we don't turn everybody into an expert. We don't turn everybody into a world-class athlete. But we do want to be the best in the world at providing a service to those who care about sport.
And you've been on this board for quite some time now. We're seeing it, at the pro levels anyway, Canadians in a lot of other sports other than just hockey really reaching the elite of the elite in basketball, a few number one overall picks, and baseball and many other sports. So I'm assuming you're seeing a lot of that, even from when you started until now, the increase in talent at the amateur level?
We see more talented young people. We see fewer participants. And we know the reason for that, of course, is the machine that keeps you home. You sit downstairs and communicate with your buddies. You don't go out and compete. There are a whole bunch of...
Finance is a concern?
Finances can be a concern, but that's one of the reasons that we exist. Until recently, we had something called a development initiative project so that a club or an individual who needed help to move forward in sport for training or coaching or whatever could come to us and get a reasonable amount of support. In recent years, the changing economies made that a little difficult, but we still do what we can.
I wanted you in studio today to give a little shout on that, but also you were really the man about town when Glenn Sather was in. You actually worked for the Oilers with Peter Pockington for a fun year. I know that was the best year of your life.
Actually, I've said this many times. It was in many ways the most interesting years of my life, but also the most difficult. Working for Peter Pocklington was not a walk in the park.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't think so. Classy of Edmonton, how they received him when he came back last year.
Well, the funny thing about Peter, I mean, he and I, as you know, had some serious disagreements. But the ultimate reality of Peter is that at the beginning of every project, his motives were absolutely pure, and then all of a sudden, somebody'd start to talk about money, and Peter one day told me that if there was a dollar on the table during a negotiation, it belonged to him. And he said that in English in one or two sentences, and I never forgot that.
You also worked closely with Sather, you know, from in the organization for a year, but then also hosting your show and writing and really seeing that that team, you know, develop into what they became. What, you know, the Oilers, I think it's a smart thing for them to honor him. Obviously, he was a main contributor, the architect, as they call him, for that. Dealing with him, what did you believe was his best strength or attribute?
It's so many of his former players have said it. I've said it previously, too. The best thing he did was turn the page. You could have a serious yelling match with Glenn Sather at 10 o'clock in the morning, and by noon, it was time to go have lunch. No more hard feelings. The issue had been settled. Move forward. He and Barry Fraser, who was then the chief scout, and I thought at that time the best scout in the National Hockey League, they would yell loud enough to strip paint off the walls and then that evening go out and be great social friends.
Which, you know, in a way is a good thing, because if you don't have disagreements sometimes, if you have all yes men under you, you don't have much success.
Well, we learn that with the board all the time, too. But, the reality is that was Glenn Sather's strength. That and the fact that he looked for opinions everywhere. I know often he would come to me and say, we got a chance to get so-and-so. What do you think? Can he play? Would he fit here? What kind of a guy is he? Did you ever deal with him? Those kind of questions regularly.
When Barry Fraser was the best scout, did he just lose his passion? Because we saw what they did early, and then, I don't know if resting on laurels, and we heard all the stories that he was scouting from
Mexico.
From Mexico and stuff. Was that just, kind of lost the drive?
Well, yeah, I think so. And Barry and I were good friends. I've got still great respect for him. But the story Glenn Sather said used to remind me of when he was here, was the day that they had Laurie Boschman in the organization. Laurie was a very good hockey player, but he was not a fourth-line center. They needed a fourth-line center, and he happened in conversation to say to Barry, we got to improve in that spot. And he said, let's get Kevin McClellan. And Sather said, I had never heard of him, but he was perfect. And you go back and you remember
yes.
That hockey club.
Yeah, huge
he
goal.
Was a perfect fit, the huge goal, but more important, he was the traffic cop for Dave Hunter and Pat Hughes, and that became an excellent line, really a great two-way line. And when it was necessary to clean up some difficulties and Don Jackson wasn't around and Dave Semenko wasn't around, Kevin McClellan loved that challenge.
Oh, I remember.
he wanted to fight more than anybody else. He loved to fight.
He was the one guy who literally, I remember talking to their teammate, like he really enjoyed it. Like he felt, and even Jim Poplinski, we had him on the show, he said McClellan was the guy that you were always a little worried about, because it didn't matter how many shots you'd get him the one game. He was just looking for the next game, because if he didn't get into a fight, he didn't feel like the game was complete.
That's exactly true. And the only other guy that I remember even slightly who was like that in the early days of his NHL career was John Kordick. They both loved to fight.
John Short joins us. Glenn Sather, we're discussing his history. We'll talk a lot more about some other aspects throughout the next hour. You also, maybe a lot of our younger listeners don't know, but you had a good relationship with Glenn until you wrote the article about what he was making.
Oh, that's an interesting story. I found out from an agent, and I'll even tell you the agent's name, Rich Winter. I said to Rich one day, I said, what do you do when somebody, when Glenn Sather says to you, I'd love to sign your kid, but we can't afford it. He then said, I asked Glenn how much he was making. And I said, how much is he making? And he told me. It was an incredible amount of money. And
that was like $2 million or something, wasn't it?
It was $2 million. Yeah. It was more than any other coach-general manager combination was getting in the NHL at that time. And here we were in a market where Pocklington every day was walking out asking for money. So I called Glenn and I said, you know, I've got this information. I can't sit on it. And Glenn said, well, it's none of your business. We're a private company. And I said, Glenn, you're a private company with your hand out. If you were just operating day to day, nobody ever cared about the economics. Nobody was ever hearing the threat that the team might have to leave. Then it's probably not a story. But in this case, it's a story. And he told me that I was no longer welcome around him. And for a long time, I wasn't. But later, we shook hands and kind of eased that issue.
And that's what I wanted to ask you. How many years did it take before, you know, because you had mentioned earlier one of his best attributes was that 10 minutes later it was forgotten.
Well, you know me. I'm the guy that could carry a grudge a little too.
What? I've never been on that end of it, but yes, I've seen it.
No, it was one of those things. We never had an opportunity to talk. I didn't seek it. He didn't seek it. When we were not, I wouldn't say we were forced together, but when we were in a situation where a choice was made, we shook hands and talked quite comfortably for the rest of the evening.
And at that time, that was that 94? Three? I can't remember the exact year it was, but Glenn eventually obviously left Edmonton and then went on to New York. Mm-hmm. When the story came out, what was the fallout outside of you and Sather not speaking?
I don't know. I don't really know that there was any. I know that Pocklington got angry at me because Peter said, well, you know, Glenn's worth it. And I said, you have to argue with me to convince me that anybody at that time in the National Hockey League was worth $2 million in a year and a team that continued to claim that it was losing money. Now, the other thing that Sather did that was remarkable, his loyalty to the people who treated him well was remarkable. If you think about it, the difficulties that the Oilers have had with Kevin Lowe and Craig McTavish and so many other former Oilers in the organization started with Sather, who wanted to keep his friends and his trusted lieutenants close to him. And they never changed that until last year, when the decision was made to go and get another general manager, to go and get another head coach. I think it was long overdue. But I was never as critical as a lot of people over the reason for it, because I know that that's what Kevin Lowe learned, it's what Craig McTavish learned, it's what Dave Semenko learned, what Kelly Buckberger learned. Name all of the people who were former Oilers players and how well they were treated. That was because Glenn Sather's loyalty to the people who had treated him well.
And it's interesting because that's not just Edmonton that does that. You look around the history of pro sports, and loyalty is such a good trait to have, but at times it does seem in pro sports that it can be somewhat blind loyalty where you let guys hang on past the time that they should be there. And Edmonton's not the only organization that's done it. Many have done it.
No, well, see, it hurts more because Edmonton has paid an incredible price for it. And the other element, and, you know, I worked in Montreal, worked in Toronto, as you know, and everybody says it's impossible to play in Toronto because of the pressure of Toronto. Impossible to play in Montreal because of the pressure of Montreal. I'm sorry. The pressure of playing in Edmonton has been as serious as the pressure of playing anywhere, because never in Toronto does somebody walk up and say, I saw Gretzky every night. I saw Curry every night. I saw Coffey every night. That's the pressure that you get in Edmonton, and it's a small community. During the winter, if you don't curl or you don't leave town on the weekend to go skiing, you're a hockey nut. That's all there is here. And there are no options, no choices. If you're a sports fan, you're a hockey guy, and you know everybody, you know all their histories, you know their faces. You can, I mean, follow them in and out of. I know. I've seen people follow the old Oilers in and out of a restaurant or in and out of a department store just so they could go home and say, guess what? I walked behind Pat Hughes, and he's not as big as you think he was.
And well, you take that and you magnify it 100-fold with phones and social media today. And, you know, the young older players, if they go to a bar, which they have every right to do, from in my eyes, after a game, and, you know, as long as it's not the night before the game, whatever. But there's people now that they can't go anywhere without cameras being taken. And the privacy, I would agree with you, it's probably worse here than it is in the big markets, because there are some places there that if you wanted to go into, you could. But here in Edmonton, it's impossible.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. It's a great place to play when you win.
Yes.
And I go back many years to talking to a minor player. Don't look at me like that. You know I go back many years. But I remember talking to a minor league hockey player years ago in Calgary, and they had lost several games. This is the old Western Hockey League team. I said, what's that all about? What do you do now? You've lost four in a row. He said, you walk in the alley a lot. Well, in Edmonton, going into the alley wasn't going to help, because somebody, especially now, is going to say, do you know I saw so-and-so walking in the alley the other day? What's the matter? Hasn't he got enough nerve to show his face downtown? And that's the hardship. But again, the joy is for those who succeed. It's a wonderful place. I've never heard Wayne Gretzky in any moment. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with him that have had very little to do with life as Wayne Gretzky, just one-on-one people conversations. He's never said a negative word about Edmonton, ever. He just, he's unable to, I think.
John Short joining me in studio. If you've got any questions for John, you can text them to us at 10-12-60. We'll come back. We'll talk more about Glenn Sather in that time. Of course, he will be honored. John worked for the Oilers for a year, but more so covered that team during their heyday. Coming up on Edmonton Sports Leader, TSN 1260. You're listening to the Gregor Show presented by Mobile One.
Portions of this hour brought to you by The Base by River Valley Health. Training is the difference between finishing and winning. Find your potential at The Base by RVH. Call 430-9224 or visit rivervalleyhealth.com.
This is the Jason Gregor Show on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260.
.528 as the rain suddenly comes down in buckets on the west end. So get your windshield wipers on. John Short joining me in studio, the longtime Edmonton media legend. And we are discussing his time, of course, around the Oilers and Glenn Sather and more. We talked a little bit about Slats and, you know, his best attributes. Do you have a funny, memorable story of Slats from your time covering the team or working for the team?
My favorite Slats story concerns... another longtime reporter, Red Fisher, who was based in Montreal, still is based in Montreal, covered the Canadiens from day one. And he was Glenn Sather's first media ally. He loved Sather. He recognized his character, his leadership, all these things, and realized, of course, that Glenn was anything but a great hockey player. And they became friends away from the game. And one day he asked Red Fisher to do him a favor, and if Fisher would do him a favor, he would send him an Indian painting. Now, that's a hell of an offer. He did the favor. Sather put former defenseman Jim Nielsen in coveralls and gave him a paintbrush, sent him a picture. that's Glenn Sather.
Did Red laugh?
He still laughs, probably, if you ask him about it.
Obviously, it was an easy favor.
But it was the fact is, it was a prank. You want Indian painting? I had a picture of an Indian painting.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a good one. That's
he was thoroughly accurate.
He was, you know, we had Kevin Lowe on earlier this week, and, you know, just talking about how, well, and for Kevin, because he lost his father at a young age, Glenn was really somewhat of a father figure to those young guys, and I can't remember which player said, you know what, he'd give us enough rope to hang ourselves and then we'd come and undo the noose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like he let them live. And it was interesting, Kevin, how he mentioned how when they were on the road, he encouraged them to go to museums and other areas to be more than just a hockey player.
One of the first things he had me do, and this was when the Oilers were still in the WHA, as you know, I did the WHA for 1 year and then the expansion season in the NHL. But the first thing he had me do was sit down with the younger players, and they were all young at that point, and even those who had some experience like Dave Lumley and so on, they hadn't ever been exposed to so-called big city media and the NHL media. And he had me sit down with them individually and talk about how you answer questions. What's the difference between radio? How do you respond to a radio interview? How do you respond in television? What do you do for someone who wants to put you on television? And now I sometimes get frustrated at that, because the first thing you teach them is you don't have to say anything controversial. So what we've done is dumbed down the entire media coverage, and I wasn't the only one, but we all did that back in the 80s. It was, well, you don't have to be excitable, and there's nothing more time-consuming than walk into the dressing room after a game. You walk in and say, I would really like to ask you this, and you ask it, and you get an answer that you could have created all by yourself without ever leaving the press box.
Yeah, and it's one where I've always felt in the NHL, they really want to temper the personalities of their players.
But they do it with everybody. At least they want to with everybody. In some cases, you can't because you get the guys. I mean, you were never going to temper, use your word, you were never going to temper Theo Fleury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were never going to get him to stop saying what he wanted to say. And there are several of those who go through the NHL on a regular basis. But Kevin McClellan, who one-on-one was as inflammatory as anybody I've ever talked to, you sit down and interview Kevin, and all of a sudden, instead of being called Shorty or that jerk reporter, you were Sir. The answer was as polite as you could have it be. And then he'd say, are we off the record? And you go off the record and he'd tell you an entirely different story, but you didn't dare use it because you might wind up in hospital tomorrow.
Of those Oiler teams, you know, everybody talks about, you know, the great ones, of course, Gretzky and Curry and Messi, and you go down the list. For you, who was the player that was maybe the most important who never gets talked about?
Well, over the period of years, there'd be several. For me, the first important Oiler was Lee Foglin. He was the first draft choice in the expansion. We went to Montreal in that expansion draft. And what he taught those kids about preparation and professional integrity was amazing. He was anything but a great defenseman, but he paid a great price to be a good defenseman, and that rubbed off. If you want to go back a year before that, Paul Schmier, another defenseman who played briefly in the NHL to no great effect, was an incredible leader. Now, if you want to talk about the guys who developed great reputations as players, Yari Curry's character was incredible. One of the stories, Dave Semenko was suspended. And I don't know whether it was a Calgary game. It was certainly a game that was going to be very physical coming up. And the question was asked during a media scrum, what's going to happen if things get serious, broadly, who's going to look after Gretzky? Yari Curry said, me, I will. Well, you never heard anything more unlikely in your life. He said, I'm ready to. At which point he turned over his vest. He was wearing a sheriff's badge.
Yeah. I do remember, didn't Yari and Wayne get into like a simultaneous fight with Neil Broughton? Is that who it was?
Well, it started.
Yeah.
And Neil, who weighed 111 pounds, was doing really well against both of them.
I know. That was the great part about it. You know, it's interesting, though. You can talk about Lee Foglin being this really good leader and mentor, but if the other players weren't good listeners to follow through on it, it doesn't mean as much, right? Like they were smart enough to pick up on what he was teaching them.
Well, but that came from the top. The respect was imposed. When you walked into an Oilers room, you recognized who the leaders were. And almost immediately, Gretzky in the last year of the WHA, others in the last year of the WHA, Dave Lumley never got any credit for paying a price to play in the National Hockey League. But he had been a career minor leaguer. He became an Oiler in the last season in the WHA. In the first year in the NHL. And he understood immediately that he was in the NHL. He could learn and pass on as a 27-year-old veteran to the other kids who were coming up and learning to play. Now, there were some who didn't ever fit the Oiler system, and they didn't stay.
Who do you think were the ones who didn't fit the most?
First would be Kenny Linsman. Kenny was absolutely an individual, wasn't popular with his teammates. His ability was appreciated, but he as a human was not appreciated very much. And, one of the stories is an team party that was scheduled, and I happened to know that the wives went to the captain at that time and asked if they could delay the party till Kenny went home.
Yeah, that's not you don't want that reputation. But and no. You know, and it's fun because it's a fine line. How and the interesting thing was, I remember the stories. You know, Kevin McClellan and Esa Tikkanen at a time. It wasn't like those guys were all singing Kumbaya and got together great off of the ice. As long as you could accept the guy's personality, but then respect him on the ice.
Well, every good team that I've ever been around, and I suspect you could say the same thing, Jason. There's there's a guy who can stand up as the leader, Mark Messier, and several others would stand up as the leader and be heard. And then there's the guy who gives everybody a pain in the butt, and he'd walk into the room at halftime or between periods and say some things. And the first response you'd get from those who weren't doing the job, I'm not going to let that jerk climb all over me. And that was as effective in many ways as having the solid leader stand up and say, come on, guys, let's get going.
Yeah, you need different ways to motivate guys sometimes.
Absolutely.
The best locker rooms, I don't believe, are 100% cohesive.
No, they're not. And even, well, again, Sather was very good at understanding those differences. He was also very good at tolerating certain things. For example, again, office parties, team parties were held not on a regular basis, but more than occasionally. And there'd be a party and a player overdo it one night, and he wouldn't be at the peak of his game tomorrow at practice. Sather understood that. He watched a guy misbehave or overdo it a little bit. He didn't jump all over him because Sather had played. Sather was a human being, knew what it was like some days not to be able. But if you didn't show up on game day, then you would pay a price.
Smart, right? As a coach, hey, if we're going to have a team function, you can't expect them to be choir boys all the time.
No, and you don't want them to be choir boys. How would you have, I mean, let's pick the names of some great players that you and I know that are incredible pests. Linsman was a pest. Theo Fleury was a pest. Kevin McClellan, whose name keeps coming up at a different level, not a great talent in any sense, but he was a pest. And in some ways, he was a hard guy to have on a team. Bill Flett, Cowboy Flett, who was here the last year in the WHA, he was an incredibly tough guy to have on a team, but he was so valuable because if he shot the puck, he might put it through the goaltender and through the net and through the backboards. And they made allowances for him. Grant Fuhr was a really interesting character to be around, and the players loved him. That isn't well known, but Grant Fuhr never blamed another teammate for a goal
ever
in all those years.
No.
And you know, you've been around it. Quite often, a goaltender can blame somebody just by glaring at him as he goes to the bench after the whistle. Fuhr never did that.
And he got left out to dry, high and dry, many occasions back in that
many
time.
Many occasions. Yeah. And yet, if you happen to get a call from somebody who ran a drinking establishment, there were certain names as public relations director that you didn't want to hear them mention. And Fuhr, fortunately, was not one of those. But there were. If the phone rang at 9 o'clock on a game day or during a 2 or 3 day layoff, there were certain names you didn't want to hear anybody mention. So-and-so was in our building last night. Oh, that's too bad. What do you think we can do about that?
And, you know, it was there, and it was just a smart way to kind of keep it quiet. Nowadays, if somebody ever runs a little awry, even at the smallest level, it's talked about, and I do think that at times is a negative about playing in a hockey man market.
Well, it is clearly a negative. And one day, and I say this with great respect for those who try seriously to communicate in blogs or on the internet, in the web, however they do it, those who want to communicate, I've got great respect for them because they care about the subject and they want to exchange the information. I don't always agree with the information. I don't always agree with the way it's distributed, but I do believe that the vast majority are sincere. What bothers me is the person who sits in the basement, picks a rumor, and just flies it. Mm-hmm. And we know that those happen.
Oh.
And there's no excuse for that.
Yeah, they happen way too often than they should. We'll come back with more with John Short on Edmonton Sports Leader, TSN 1260. You're listening to The Gregor Show, presented by Mobile One. Energy lives here.
Portions of this hour brought to you by The Sports Closet. Get into the swing of things in The Sports Closet. They have all new MLB apparel, including hats, shirts, jerseys, and more. Check them out in the Sherwood Park Mall or online at sportscloset.ca.
Loud, obnoxious, and all hours. The Jason Gregor Show on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260.
A lot of texts and tweets coming in. Many people happy to hear John on the radio again. A few asking about Al Hamilton and your thoughts on Al.
Al Hamilton as a
the
junior.
Player, yeah.
As a junior, he was as good. Most people don't believe this, but in his 17-year-old junior season, he was as good as Bobby Orr. And when I saw them both, and Everybody laughs when you say that. Orr hurt his, and was he going to be as good as Orr at the NHL? No. Even despite his knee, Bobby kept improving. But as a 17 and 18-year-old junior, Al Hamilton was as good a junior defenseman as there was in this country. And as a guy who contributes and learned some things as he matured, absolutely amazing.
If he didn't have the eye injury, would he probably be talked about as one of the, you know, a better defenseman, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. The thing I will remember, and I know Al and I have needled about it, first game he ever played, he played for the Rangers. And Frank Mahovlich made him look like a rookie, went around him and scored a goal.
Sure, yeah.
And went around him and scored a goal. And I know that it embarrassed Al, but to his credit, he has never decked from it. He said, I learned more on that one shift than I learned for a long time after.
Anybody who doesn't get, if you get lit up in the NHL by a star player, you're in the NHL getting lit up by a star player. Yeah. Most other guys would never be good enough to get in that situation.
And the thing that Al never got any credit for, when he came here, when Bill Hunter was building the WHA team that ultimately became the Edmonton Oilers of the National Hockey League, Al Hamilton was the first of the so-called big-name Edmonton guys who came home. And Edmonton owes him a debt for that, apart from the fact that he's become a really good contributing citizen. And I love the fact that I can honestly say Al Hamilton's a good friend of mine.
Randy Gregg, one of the few who was on all five cup-winning teams.
And a guy who understood his role. How often have you heard somebody say, we need everybody to understand what they do? Randy Gregg's job was to be physical but not rough. He was a big, strong guy. He skated well enough. But you think back at it, how many defensemen in the National Hockey League now are recognized for their ability to provide the excellent, almost perfect breakout pass? That's what Randy Gregg did.
Yeah, he was an excellent first passer.
First pass, and he was physical enough. Nobody messed with him because he was a big, strong guy, and he was intensely competitive. I mean, he had that red hair for a reason, you know.
I want to get your thoughts. You know, you've been around for a long time. You saw the Trappers leave. What's your thoughts on the Rush situation?
I think it's a shame whenever a community this size loses a sports team. I watched the Rush. I heard you brag about your involvement with the Rush, and that's fair, because I've always bragged about my involvement with the Trappers. I think it's a shame. I think it was badly handled from beginning to end. Now, I don't know the details. I don't know whether Urban was to blame for some of it. I don't know whether City
Council
was. All
three parties were to blame.
But whatever it was too bad, and I do believe that the opportunity to be a mediator was the mayor's. He had a chance to put the Oilers, who were incredibly greedy about their space in this situation, he had a chance to put the Oilers and Urban on the same page, and he didn't do it. For whatever reason, and he can say, well, he wasn't interested or somebody didn't cooperate, that's okay. But he had an obligation and an opportunity, and he didn't do it.
I got it from Urban and his side that at a certain price they would have sold. Pass that information on, and it never happened. And to me, the most disappointing thing is, because I know that the Oilers want a lacrosse, everybody knows the new facility, they manage it, they have to manage evenings. You're not going to have concerts filling it up every night. It's not going to happen. It's wishful thinking. The Toronto ACC has the Raptors, they have the Leafs, they have lacrosse, and they still have all the concerts, right? There's no pro basketball team here.
No.
Right. Yeah, I get that there's the Old Kings, but let's be honest. It's not the same as pro basketball when you're talking revenue and everything else. And to me, it was an easy one. And I fully expect to see expansion NLL team in Edmonton within two or three seasons. The problem is it'll be an expansion team and it'll be basically the same price you could have purchased a championship team for.
Now, let me give you another question, another point. A couple of years ago in my role with the Alberta Sport Connection, I went to the Canada Summer Games in Sherbrooke, Quebec, which is about, less than half the size of Edmonton. The facilities in Sherbrooke, Quebec are vastly superior to the facilities we have here. I wrote it at the time when I came back. I remember thinking and writing and saying when I had an opportunity that they had 10 and 12,000 seat facilities that were absolutely full of sports teams. I mean, we can talk about the Eddies soccer team. They need a facility. If they don't need a facility that's separate from the one that's used now for high school football and age and junior football, than the football guys do. High school sport is not being well treated as the pro sports expand here. We have to get broader at the high school level. We have to get broader at so-called the minor sport level. And you can't say that the Rush were minor sport. At the very least, they were intermediate sport and perhaps headed to be major sport. Done well, supported well, we might have got to a stage where they were drawing 12, 13, 14, 15,000 people.
It happens easily in Toronto and in Calgary. And, you know, obviously marketing, I always said that was the Rush's biggest problem. Was the owner great to deal with people all the time? No. But, hey, there's many other owners in the city of Edmonton in the history that have not a reputation of being great to deal with. This is not a first.
And you say that to a guy who worked for Peter Brocklington. let me do this. Let's go back to the fact now that the big guy in sport wants to control his market. And it takes me all the way back to the Trappers. And the Edmonton Eskimos were incredibly self-centered in getting rid of the Trappers. They found a way to get rid of them. They got rid of them. They made some money in getting rid of them. And that's acceptable now.
Do you think they would have stayed here, though? And do you think that league would allow them to be the one team so far away?
There was nothing, I heard this from Mel Kowalczyk, who ran the team at the time, and I heard it also from the commissioner of the league at that time. Unfortunately, I've forgotten his name. But he said there was nothing in the framework of the league that would allow them to say, you can't stay. As long as you're current, you can stay.
Okay.
So ultimately, maybe we'd have lost the team anyway. But it's always galled me that we lost the team because another team wanted them out.
Well, which is, to me, an underlying picture of what happened here, too. I totally agree with you, and that's unfortunate because there's still people nowadays who miss AAA baseball. They still, it's talked about all the time and how they miss it.
Well, and this isn't well known, but the city has sent a circular to various organizations, including Major League Baseball, including individuals with dollars in their pockets in this community, asking if there is any way that they could resurrect a certain
AAA
level
baseball.
Not necessarily AAA, but a level of baseball that would be adequate to allow us to keep Telus Field. Because as you know, there's a large movement now that we should take that area and turn it into residences too.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I want Telus Field kept here, and I hope that the community recognizes that the city has opened the door to that. Now, how seriously, I don't know. What kind of responses they're getting, I don't know. But I do know that a letter's been distributed, and it's a circular, actually, recommending that if you're interested, please make contact.
Quickly, John, your thoughts on Connor McDavid and what he will mean to the organization.
I feel sorry for him. I feel sorry for him. I don't know how any 17-year-old kid can handle the heat that he's going to get when he gets here. Do I believe he's the next great player? It would be presumptuous as heck for you or me to sit here and say he can't be or he will be. The experts say he's going to be, so let's hope he stays healthy, and let's hope that he is, and let's hope that he survives the incredible pressure he's going to face in the first two or three years here, in which case we'll be able to say not only did we have Gretzky and all of those other greats who so often are not mentioned, but now we've got Connor McDavid, we've got something else to build on. I think that'd be fabulous, but we've just talked about how tough it will be to play here.
Mm-hmm.
How tough is it going to be to play here as an 18-year-old kid when everybody says you're the next great one?
It'll definitely be difficult. I think the saving grace is he does have a lot of other first-round picks that he can lean on, so that's maybe the only saving grace, at least two anyway.
Can I ask you one more question about that? What's going to happen to the first-round picks who all of a sudden aren't getting page one attention? What's going to happen?
The only one that would be, I think, is Hall, and I think he's so sick of losing. He's going to be the one playing with McDavid. I think he'd like it. I think Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is the biggest benefactor of everyone in the organization of having McDavid because now he doesn't have to play all the tough minutes.
But he's also not going to play all the power play minutes.
True, but you got two power play units. You can. I think the good teams can succeed. I think Nugent-Hopkins is actually the biggest benefactor in this entire thing.
Well, I hope that's the case because I've got so much respect for the way he's conducted himself through the whole process. And of course, there are rumors all over the place, and I admit that there are rumors all over the place, perhaps no foundation at all, that a couple of years ago, Hall was looking to get out. I have no reason to believe it.
Yeah,
I can tell you
that 100% is not true.
Okay.
I asked the player directly on many different occasions, so. That one, not true. But sick of losing, yes, that is 100% accurate.
Well, and that'll get turned around. And again, it may not get turned around this year. I think the biggest change that they made, the most beneficial change they made, was bringing in a general manager with no firm connection to the previous organization.
John, always great to catch up with you. We'll do this again soon. I hope things are well, and all the best at the Alberta Sports Connection.
All the best. Will involve some serious conversations about budgets coming up very soon. And you know about me and budgets. Basically, I say if we got it, we might as well spend it. Thanks. It's been fun, Jason.
Spoken like a Pocklington disciple right there. I love it. let's get to a SportsCenter update with Majot. And then we got the highlight reel. Good night.